Now you should be getting on. Hello, everybody. I want to wish everyone a Shana Tova Metukah, good in this week here. I know that we, the Jewish people, Eretz Yisrael, is going through a very difficult period immediately right now, and I appreciate the fact that even to come to a shir is a certain degree of mesiras nefesh, a certain degree of devotion and commitment. And in the merit of that devotion, Hashem should keep you all safe together with all your families and all of Am Yisrael. People come to rabbis and people come to teachers and they ask, you know, what are we supposed to think in a time like this? And the truth of the matter is no one really has any particular answers. We do know that before the Mashiach coming, there will be what is called Chavle Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach. Birth, as at least the women can attest, can often be very, very painful, and labor can in fact be protracted. We hope it'll be a short labor, or indeed it's already been pretty long considering 2,000 years and the like. But Chazal do tell us that Eretz Yisrael is acquired with Yisurin, with suffering and with difficulties. And we are going through this process, and in many, many ways, the Gemara actually says, a certain rabbi said, I hope Mashiach will come, but I don't want to be around when he does come, because it'll be such a difficult time. You know, Chazal traditionally speak about the four exiles, Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and then the Gullus of Edom, the Roman Gullus, which Western civilization is a successor to the Roman Gullus. And Rome, of course, destroyed, which is descended from Esav, or at least connected to Esav, destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash, so we call that Gullus Edom. But in Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer, a Medrash, it identifies there will be a fifth Gullus, which will be the worst and most bitterest of all of the Goliot, and this will be the ascendancy of Malchus Yishmael, of the Ishmaelite kingdom, from whom the Arabs and, obviously Yishmael was not Islam, but the Arab nations and the Arab cultures come from Yishmael. And Rav Chaim Vital, the great disciple of the Ari, wrote 500 years ago that the Golus of Yishmael will be far more bitter and far more difficult than any other Golus that we've ever experienced. A Golus of unparalleled cruelty, a Golus of destruction for the sake of destruction. And moreover, in ways that we don't understand, Yishmael has certain spiritual merits that make them very, very difficult to fight. Yishmael has the merit of Bris Milah, the covenant of circumcision. Yishmael, as seen in their name, Yishmael, God listens, has a certain power of prayer. And there is, and this is actually a Hasidic thought, a Kabbalistic thought taken over by Hasidus, just as, if you remember the old film cameras, nobody has them anymore, but if you, the older people might remember the camera that used film, and you used to have something called a photographic negative. And from, really old time ago, right? Long time ago. But you had the photographic negative, and from the negative you reconstruct the positive. So too the Mekubalim teach us that there's such a thing as dark spiritual energy. That even when something is evil and perverted, there may be a certain spiritual energy which can only be vanquished with positive spiritual energy. Part of the lesson that we see in the tragedies that we're going through, and it's a very, very hard lesson, is that sometimes we're confronted with situations where there's really nothing we can really do. We can take this step and that step, but somebody, you know, can kill you with a pen or a screwdriver or whatever it is. This is not something, you know, there are not enough police, they can't act fast enough. You know, you have your pepper spray, and you're on a bus where a guy starts shooting a machine gun. Well, your pepper spray is not going to help you in the back of the bus. In a sense, this is a situation of helplessness. This is a situation where there's really very little we can do. Now, that often creates despair. That often creates despondency. But the Briskerov, who lived through the Warsaw Ghetto before he came to Eretz Yisrael, the Briskerov was often very tense and nervous about, did he do his mitzvahs right? Did he say Shema? Did he make Havdalah? He was very conscientious and worried about mitzvahs. But in the Warsaw Ghetto, he seemed to have been unusually calm. And one of his students had the chutzpah to ask him, you know, Rebbe, you're always so nervous, uptight. Why are you so calm in the Warsaw Ghetto? And his answer was, I am nervous when the responsibility is on me. Doing mitzvot is my responsibility. Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is in the hands of God, except the decision to serve Hashem. When it's up to me, I'm nervous. But what happens if you're in a situation where there's nothing you can really do about it? There, bedafka, I feel calm. Because I know HaKadosh Baruch Hu's in charge. And I don't understand God's ways. And I don't know why things happen. But I know they're not random. I know they're not chaotic. I know they're out of Hashem's love in ways that we don't always understand. So the Brisker Rav said that the very helplessness of our situation can be a cause for reassurance and calmness and serenity. Because that is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes over. So this is very, very difficult, and our heart certainly has to go out and does go out for the people that have died, for the parents that have lost their children, for the loss to Am Yisrael of their children. I mean, Rav Henkin, who was himself potentially someone who could have been one of the Gedolim of the next generation. And Judaism does not deny the reality of suffering, unlike Buddhism, for example, which kind of says suffering is an illusion and you just can't let it bother you. We're supposed to mourn. We're supposed to grieve. We're supposed to cry. We're supposed to feel pain, especially of others. It's one thing to be calm when it comes to your problem, but you don't be a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon, as Rabbi Saul Salanter said. So we don't deny the reality of suffering. And we're supposed to feel it. But side by side, we recognize that God is a God of love, and with emunah and bitachon, He will take us out of this. Am Yisrael has been through many, many, many difficult situations. Situations that were worse than this one. I mean, I talk about the Holocaust. I mean, you can't compare apples and oranges, but we've had so many tragedies. And people have died, and individuals have suffered, but Am Yisrael continues. And with emunah and bitachon, Am Yisrael will continue again in our lands. And Mir Hashem, this should be the chavle Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach, that will bring us to a geula. And again, part of how we bring the geula is we're moser nefesh to serve Hashem, even when a situation is difficult. So in a sense, by your coming today, you've contributed at least a little bit to bringing the geula hasida, because you've shown HaKadosh Baruch Hu that you're not a fair-weather friend. Fair-weather friend says, I go with God, you know, when things go my way. When things don't go my way, you know, I look for something else. The test of a maimon is, I go with Hashem even when times are difficult, and especially when times are difficult. So that's just a little bit of thought. Let me tell you a Hasidish vort. Again, this is a, I'll get to the nature of the course itself in a moment. But this was from a relative of the Baal Shem Tov. It's not from the Baal Shem Tov, but the Baal Shem Tov would say it over. And it's really quite ingenious. It would be better if I would have almost a blackboard or a whiteboard to illustrate it. And that is the following. The Mabul came to the world because the world was corrupt. The world was evil. The world was degenerate. And the phrase that the Torah uses to describe a degenerate world is a word that we can identify, at least as a pun, Ki malaha aretz chamas mipnehem. The world was filled with violence. Chamas. Again, chamas. Again, obviously there would be a connection spiritually between that. But the Baal Shem Tov's relative offered the following observation. And some of this I will not be able to fully explain because I don't fully understand, but I'll just share with you the association. Based on the Zohar, there are two sources of evil in the world. And they are represented symbolically by two words. One is nachash, the snake, that was the source of bringing sin and evil into the world. Nachash. The other is said to be one of the angels, the Satan, and one of the Satan's names is Samael. Actually, we shouldn't even say the word, but it's Samach Mem Aleph Lamed. So without fully understanding the symbolism, evil is concretized through the medium of nachash, and the angel Samach Mem Aleph Lamed. Now, based on this, it is said to be the following. Even within evil, God normally puts boundaries in the world that evil is not allowed to spread indefinitely. Either there's a sense of moral conscience, a sense of outrage, the nations of the world eventually rise up, meaning Hitler, whatever it would be. There is a gavul, there is a boundary. Now, in the word nachash, the way that's expressed is with the first letter and the last letter, meaning ches is the evil, and the shin and the nun, or the nun and the shin, is shein. Shein is tooth. Now, what do teeth do? They hold back the tongue. So, in the word nachash, the shin and the nun represent God holding back evil from its fullest expansion. Similarly, in the angel of destruction, Samael, Samach Mem can mean poison, but Aleph Lamed is God's name. It is fear of God. People have some fear of God in which they're not going to go beyond a certain level. So, within evil, there is normally a built-in constraint. That is symbolized by the Shin and Nun in Nachash, and that is symbolized by the Aleph Lamed in Samael. Now, take away those restraints and see what type of word you get. If you take away the shin and the nun, I apologize for this being a little complicated, but if you take away the shin and the nun from nachash, you're left with a ches. And if you take away the aleph and lamed from Samael, you're left with samach mem. Ches, mem samach, is chamas. Chamas represents the power of evil in nachash and Samael, when all of the constraints of the fear of God are removed. And that is when God had to destroy the world, ki mala ha'aretz chamas, when evil has no constraint. Now, to make this even more fascinating, what letters represent constraint? The shin and the nun, which is 350, and aleph and lamed, which is 130. Let's remember the dimensions of Noach's ark. It was 300 amos long and 50 amos wide and 30 amos high and one amma. It came to a point of one amma. In other words, all of the goodness that existed in the world went into the Teva, into the physical dimensions of the Teva. In other words, the physical dimensions of the Teva actually equal the gematria of the shin and the nun and the aleph and the lamed, leaving in the world chamas. And that is really what is so frightening, that when there's no longer a sense of morality, no longer a sense of conscience, where in fact evil now becomes good, and that is truly frightening. And this is really the test of emunah, bitachon, and trust in Hashem, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help us. Now, going back to this specific course, I do want to say that I don't want to be guilty of false advertising. I'm not going to give you the innermost secrets of Chabad. Number one, I can't say that I know them. Number two, if I knew them, I wouldn't tell you. Or as the saying goes, forgive my language, if I tell you, I'd have to kill you afterwards. And, you know, God forbid. So this is not going to be about the innermost secrets of Chabad. And certainly I'm not going to get into so much of the present political controversies. Chabad is a fascinating movement. And again, Derech Agav, I will touch on all sorts of things. But primarily, we're going to learn a little bit of some selections from the Sefer HaTanya, the book Tanya. And I'll talk about, even the title is very interesting. What is the official title of the book? Was authored by the founder of the Hasidus known as Chabad. It was not called Lubavitch in those days because the Alter Rebbe never set foot in Lubavitch. Lubavitch became the town of the Rebbes only in the second and third generations, and only for around 100 years. Then they moved around. But the founder of Chabad Hasidus was an extraordinarily great individual, Rabbi Schneer Zalman. His town was of Liadi in Belarus, and he goes by many names. He is called the Alter Rebbe in Yiddish. Some people call him Harav, the Rav. He is called Admor HaZaken, which is just the Hebrew. Admor is an abbreviation that all Hasidic groups use. Adonenu, Morenu, V'Rabenu, our master, our teacher, our Rabbi. That is not only a Chabad title. I mean, we talk about Ha'admor Migor, Ha'admor Mibels, Ha'admor Milubavitch. So Ha'admor HaZaken is the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad. Now, let me point out that although, unfortunately, people identify Tanya as a book exclusively for Lubavitcher Hasidim, that is not at all the case. Tanya is part of the legacy of Am Yisrael. It is a fundamental sefer in Jewish ethical philosophy. And it was widely studied by, number one, many other Hasidic groups besides Chabad. And it was studied by many non-Hasidic people as well. In recent years, because of various political controversies, so Tanya for a while was limited only to Chabad, and if you got caught learning Tanya, they would kick you out of yeshiva, in a non-Chabad yeshiva, etc. But that really was a deviation from the way it was normally understood. Just like Mesilas Yesharim is a sefer that belongs to Am Yisrael, Tanya is also a sefer that belongs to Am Yisrael. But in order to put the Tanya in perspective, I need to go back a little bit and talk about the founding of Hasidus as a movement, the early generations of Hasidus, and in particular the controversies between what are called the Misnagdim, the opponents of Hasidus, and the Hasidim, especially the involvement of the Vilna Gaon, who typically did not get involved in many public issues. The Vilna Gaon was almost totally involved in just learning and teaching Torah. And yet, the one issue in which he did get actively involved was the pulmus, the fight against Hasidus and the like. One little point I want to make, that the Alter Rebbe used to say that it was a great gift min hashamayim, because it's interesting. The term Hasidim, which means pious ones, that is a term that appears in the Gemara many times. The Gemara talks about the Hasidim Arishonim, the early pious ones who would daven, and before they would daven, they'd prepare for an hour, and they would daven for an hour, and then they would meditate for an hour afterwards, so they would effectively be osek in prayer 9 hours a day. And they were called Hasidim Arishonim. And the Gemara itself talks about the difference between a tzaddik and a chasid. A tzaddik keeps the law, keeps the dinim, is righteous. A chasid goes beyond the law. So chasid is a very, very high description of a pious, righteous, holy individual. In fact, people say God has a sense of humor. During the Vilna Gaon's lifetime, the most common title that he was known as was HaChasid MiVilna. While he was fighting the Baal Shem Tov's Hasidus, he was called the Chasid MiVilna. The Ramchal, who was before the Baal Shem Tov, was called Chasid. So Chasid, as a description of a righteous, holy person, has nothing to do with Hasidus, as we have it today. So the Alter Rebbe used to say that the movement of which he was a part, the term Hasidim was given to them by their opponents, and it was said sarcastically. Who do these people think they are, Hasidim? And the people who opposed Hasidim gave themselves the name Misnagdim, the opponents. Now, if you think about it, Hasidim is so positive, such a positive word. Misnagdim is such a negative word. So the Baal HaTanya said, it was Hashem's Rachamim that our opponents gave us such a positive name, and they took for themselves such a negative name. After all, theoretically, the opponents could have called themselves the true Hasidim, the Vilna Gaon, and they could have called us the Misnagdim, the ones who are opposing normative Judaism. So the Baal HaTanya says, you see, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had Rachamim on us, that even our enemies gave us a beautiful name that would be Moshech Eshalef. Okay. So be it as it may, the so-called founder of Hasidus, although we're going to see that this is far from clear and there's a lot of anachronistic thinking in which you're looking later and reading it back into the past, but the founder of the movement is universally said to be a rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Baal, well, his name was Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, and he eventually became known as the Baal Shem Tov, and that's often abbreviated as Besht. Besht is simply Beis Ayin Shin Tesh, Baal Shem Tov. Now, let me explain a little bit. What is this title called Baal Shem? Because he was not the first person to have the title Baal Shem. You can actually go back through history, and throughout the Middle Ages, there were different rabbis who went with the appellation Baal Shem. Usually not Baal Shem Tov, though. That's kind of a little distinction he has. But a person was called Rebbe Leo Baal Shem. In fact, the Baal Shem Tov had teachers. Rebbe Leo Baal Shem, Rav Yoel Baal Shem. There was even a very mysterious Adam Baal Shem, which is very unusual because Adam is commonly not used as a name. Now, Baal Shem literally means master of the name. And this was a term that was used for Kabbalists, people who were very, very deep in the study of Kabbalah. And in particular, they would have different meditations on different combinations of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name. And some of the names you don't even know, like the 72-letter name or the 42-letter name and the like. And through their various meditations and combinations, they would achieve certain levels akin to Ruach HaKodesh or prophecy. They would sometimes be able to do miracles and the like. Some of them would often heal the sick. So Baal Shem, in that sense, was almost a term for designated mystical people who would use the koach of Kabbalah to do various good things in the world. In that sense, the Baal Shem Tov was simply following the tradition of his teachers. He became a great Kabbalist. Now again, there are many, many legends about the Baal Shem Tov. He was orphaned as a young man. And as a young man, he made a living in many, many different ways. But he said the greatest, most beautiful part of his life was in his 20s, his late teens and his 20s. He was a teacher of young children, a cheder rebbe. And, you know, the cheder rebbe sometimes is a bad stereotype, as, you know, when he would beat the children and the like, although that may be exaggerated. But the Baal Shem Tov was unusual for the kindness and gentility in which he would teach the children, and he would give them piggyback rides, he would give horseback rides or whatever it is. He would, you know, carry them. He would bring them treats. He would take them out into the forest to meditate about Hashem. And he said later that the happiest time of his life was when he taught children the Aleph Beis and the beginning of Chumash. Because they were so pure, and they just took to God's Torah with a great deal of love. But at the same time, even as a young man, the Baal Shem Tov seemed to have almost a double life. Externally, he was known as a very, very fine cheder teacher. You know, people loved him, the children loved him. But he seemed to be a simple person. He did not convey the impression of being learned or profound. You know, good heart, good nature, kind person. But apparently, even at a very young age, in 18 or 19, he was already hanging around these various mystics, Rav Yoel Baal Shem, etc. And he was into Kabbalah and the like. And later, when he left the cheder system, he would wander from city to city, often as an itinerant beggar. And if you read stories of the Baal Shem Tov, and even later Hasidic rabbis, you often see this motif of being a concealed tzaddik, who would give people chizuk and strength, encouragement, give them insight, often clothed in very simple teachings. In other words, the Baal Shem Tov did not sit down and give a Gemara shir or a Kabbalah shir. They would often be very, very simple, direct teachings, but they were based on the deepest levels of the Torah. Towards the end of his life, he began to gather disciples. But I want to point out, the Baal Shem Tov never really started a mass movement. The Baal Shem Tov interacted with people in a one-to-one basis. The Baal Shem Tov was just like a presence who would show up in your town. And if you happened to have been a depressed or a person with broken spirit, he would somehow find his way to you. Maybe he was the janitor cleaning up after a bar mitzvah or whatever it is. And somehow he would be where he was needed. And he would encourage and raise up. He was, in other words, the point I'm making is, he did not found a movement called Hasidus. He was a spiritual healer, a great Kabbalist. But it is true that towards the end of his life, he began to get famous. After all, if there's enough individual people that you help, eventually you do get famous. This reminds me a little bit of an interview, I don't know why he did this, that Rav Moshe Feinstein did with the New York Times on his 70th birthday. Why he did it, I have no idea. And the New York Times reporter asked him, kind of a strange question, but you know, people say you're the greatest rabbi in the world, like, you know, why do people go to you when they have questions? So Rav Feinstein, with his very endearing simplicity, said, well, you know how it is, somebody asks you a question and they like the answer, so they tell somebody else, hey, there's this rabbi, you know. So eventually a lot of people ask you questions because, you know, that's how Rav. So essentially that's what happened to the Baal Shem Tov, meaning to say, he was not making a movement. He didn't have a yeshiva. He didn't even have that many students, so to speak. But it was one-to-one cheder Rebbe impact on children. He wandered around. He got married into a very, very prominent family because his father-in-law saw who he was. But the brother-in-law, who was one of the great rabbis in Poland, was so embarrassed with his ignorant brother-in-law that he sent him away. He said, you can't even live in this city. Later, they got to know each other. This is Reb Gershon Kitteber. You'll find there's a lot of correspondence and letters between the Baal Shem Tov and Reb Gershon Kitteber. But initially, Reb Gershon Kitteber thought, oh yeah, I was so ashamed that my sister marries this Amoritz. But eventually, the Baal Shem Tov did get a reputation. And in fact, there was a recent book somebody wrote, well, it's not so recent, maybe around 15 years ago. It's called The Historical Baal Shem Tov. And this person went back to the land records in Poland, and there's actually a record of this Israel Baal Shem, whatever it is in Polish, and he was given a tax. He didn't have to pay property tax to the Polish government because his house was legally registered as a synagogue, and he was known as a wonder rabbi and the like. And towards the end of his life, he began to gather different disciples, and he would teach them Kabbalah, and he would teach them the fundamentals of Avas Yisrael, loving Jews, and the like. And again, let me point out the following. Let me point out that there are two general ideas to know about the Baal Shem Tov. You know, I'm not going to talk about the Baal Shem Tov extensively, but you need to know this as the background to the Tanya, because it's going to be connected. The Tanya is, Shneur Zalman is the third generation of Hasidus. Baal Shem Tov is first, and then we'll talk about the Maggid of Mezirich in a moment. The Baal Shem Tov came shortly after the Chelmanitsky massacres. Now, the Chelmanitsky massacres were the Cossack massacres in the Ukraine in the 1600s and the 17th century. The Baal Shem Tov is the generation after that. You have to understand that, although in retrospect we have the Holocaust and the like, but the Chelmanitsky massacres were very, very devastating. Not only were there hundreds of thousands of Jews that were killed, but gedolim, yeshivos, kihilos were uprooted. And the Jewish people were very, very demoralized. And as a result, there's, and by the way, it was also after the Shabtai Tzvi false Mashiach. So a number of reactions occurred within the Jewish people. And that is, many, many great rabbis felt that as a result of the sufferings and destructions, we have to buckle down, learn Torah more intensively, learn, write chidushim, write halachos. We have to become stricter in keeping halachos and the like. And particularly in the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi, where many, many Jews followed this false Mashiach who converted to Islam. And then Shabtai Tzvi was followed with a Jacob Frank, who was an absolute Russia, who taught perversely, that you achieve holiness by sinning and then doing tshuva. Of course, he never got to the tshuva part, but he actually said, we become closer to God by sinning. There was a tremendous reaction against Kabbalah. So both the Chelmanitsky massacre and the Shabtai Tzvi created within the leadership of Am Yisrael a certain closed-mindedness in which all we're going to do is learn the revealed parts of the Torah, not Kabbalah, not mysticism, because that led so many people astray in Shabtai Tzvi. That was based on perversions of Kabbalah. And the emphasis was on becoming a great, great Talmud Chacham, learning Yomam Belaila. Now the problem with this was, this is a wonderful thing, and of course it's important, but the problem for this was that there were many, many common people who didn't have the opportunity to learn in depth, who couldn't really understand the complicated Talmudic discussions. And the message they got was there were riffraff. The message they got was they didn't count. They didn't matter. They're there just to serve the Talmud Chacham. And there's no intrinsic purpose and meaning to their lives. As a result, within Klal Yisrael, within the Hamonam, there was a great deal of what you might call, again, not clinical depression, but a sense of despondency, hopelessness. And again, all of these things come in together. Number one, the despondency because of the massacres, and because of the economic conditions, and because of the poverty, and because of the sickness. And the despondency as a spiritual malaise, in which people just felt, I don't matter. God really doesn't care about me, because there's nothing I can contribute. And we do have some cases, now one has to be careful not to exaggerate, Chassidus exaggerated some of these stories, where Talmidei Chachamim would be mavaza and make fun of the less learned. Now again, I want to point out that in Chassidic lore, they make this almost as if every Talmud Chacham was doing this. That was absolutely not the case. But obviously there were some cases, as there is today, to this very day. What the Baal Shem Tov tried to do in a small way, and eventually it grew, was to communicate to the average, simple, illiterate, uneducated Jew that you are special, you are loved, your mitzvos and your davening are precious to the Almighty. You keep the world alive as well. And therefore, although the Baal Shem Tov himself was a great, great scholar, and the Baal Shem Tov's teachings are rooted in the mysteries of Kabbalah, the Baal Shem Tov himself always communicated in a very simple and direct way. That's why I say many people thought he was ignorant. They didn't even realize how learned he was. And he saw as his mission in life to restore to the every single Jew a sense of how beloved they are in God's eyes. So that's really one central core of the Baal Shem Tov's teaching. The other is a story they tell that the Baal Shem Tov met Eliyahu HaNavi. Now great righteous people connect to Eliyahu HaNavi. And the Baal Shem Tov asked Eliyahu HaNavi, when will you come to announce the Mashiach? And the answer that Eliyahu HaNavi gave him was, L'chsheyafutsu mayanosecha chutza, when your wellsprings spread to all of the Jewish people, then Mashiach will come. You may recall, Chabad uses this phrase very much. The Rebbe always spoke about hafatzat mayanot, the spreading of the springs that comes from this Baal Shem Tov story. That for reasons we'll discuss, Chabad took the position that the hafatzat mayanot of the Baal Shem Tov is affected by Chabad. But I'll talk about that as well. So the point I want to make, though, is that when the Baal Shem Tovs died, there really was no movement called Chassidus. There were individual righteous people who tried to give chizuk to Am Yisrael, to an infinitely less degree, but just as a rabbi today might try to give chizuk to Am Yisrael. This is how the Baal Shem Tov perceived his mission. He saw so much sinas chinam. He saw polarization. He saw depression. He saw lack of enthusiasm, kind of a dark grayness in Avodas Hashem. And he wanted there to be simcha, even in a difficult life. And he wanted there to be unity. And this was his great message. Simple message, but a message that is rooted in very, very deep understandings of the spiritual world. Okay. Now, after the Baal, again, if I can use a Christian analogy, the founder, the founder of Christianity is not Jesus. the founder of Christianity is Paul. Because Jesus died as a Jewish man who simply said he was Mashiach. Maybe he was crazy, maybe he was lying, whatever it is, we don't have to psychoanalyze Yashka at this point. But Yashka did not found a religion. The founder of Christianity is Paul. He made it a religion. He broke it away from Judaism. The early Christians before Paul, they thought they were like Jews for Jesus. They thought you have to wear tefillin, you have to wear tzitzis. We just thought Yashka was our Mashiach. I'll discuss how that connects to Chabad also. That's an interesting story in and of itself. But the founder of Christianity as a religion was Paul, and so too, the founder of Hasidus as a movement was not Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. It was his disciple and successor, Rav Dov Ber, who is known as the Magid, the preacher of Mezarich. Mezarich is a town in the Ukraine. The Mezaricher Magid. And this is very, very interesting. Rav Dov Ber was again, obviously, he was not born a chassid, because he was really almost the same age as the Baal Shem Tov. He was not much younger, maybe less than 5 years difference between them. He came to the Baal Shem Tov when he already was a mature Talmud Chacham and Gaon, right? So he did not learn his basic Kabbalah from the Baal Shem Tov, but he saw from the neshama of the Baal Shem Tov that this was a way that he wanted to serve God. Now it's interesting that there were two potential successors. The Baal Shem Tov had around 20 students. Not hundreds, not maybe 20 disciples. Pinchas of Karetz, etc. But the two ones who were vying for succession, so to speak, one was Rav Yaakov Yitzchak of Polonia. And Rav Yaakov Yitzchak is a very, very, very important, I'm sorry, Yaakov Yosef. And the reason why his name is a very important name is he wrote the first Sefer, shortly after the Baal Shem Tov's death, the first Sefer that contained the essential ideas of Hasidic thought. Toldos Yaakov Yosef. Because the Baal Shem Tov wrote nothing, almost every quotation we have from the Baal Shem Tov is from the Toldos Yaakov Yosef. He quotes the Baal Shem Tov more than 500 times. So when you pick up a sefer that says Baal Shem Tov ala Torah, which you can get, please realize that essentially what these Sfarim are is, they are anthologies that are drawn from other sources as well, but 90% are simply lifted from the Toldos Yaakov Yosef. This is the first sefer of Hasidus. Now, obviously, Toldos Yaakov Yosef, he was a master of the ideology of Hasidus, of the lessons of Hasidus. He was a natural person to assume leadership of what would eventually become a big movement. But the problem was this. The problem was that he was very acerbic. He was very critical of non-Hasidim. Meaning, if you look at the Toldos Yaakov Yosef, which is on the Chumash, he often makes fun of non-Hasidic rabbis. He makes fun of Misnagdim. He talks about their superficiality. He talks about their gaiva. He talks about their arrogance. He talks about the fact that they think they're learned when they're not. He really gives it to them in double-barreled punches. It was thought by many that he's too sarcastic and acerbic. If we want a movement to grow, if we want a movement to attract people who, after all, grew up in non-Hasidic homes, you have to attract them with gentleness, with humility, with kindness, and with respect. You can't attract people by saying, you know, you're a shegetz unless you become a chassid. So as a result, although the Toldos Yaakov Yosef is a unanimously respected, well, at least within Hasidus, it's a unanimously respected primary source of the teachings of the Besht, the one who succeeded the Besht was not the Rav Yaakov Yosef, but it was the Magid of Mezarich, who indeed was the opposite personality-wise. The Mezaricher Magid was calm, was kind, was quiet, was gentle, was what you might call non-judgmental, and one who had great, great respect and kavod for the Gedolei Torah and Talmidei Chachamim of the non-Hasidic camp. as it were. The Magid of Mezrich was a very, very interesting person. Number one, he was a cripple. He could not really walk with great effort, and as a result, unlike the Baal Shem Tovs, whose avoda was going from town to town, the Magid of Mezrich stayed in Mezrich. He basically, you know, never left. But people would come to him. In fact, what's fascinating is, you know, you may have heard, and things are going on now. Remember, this is also the time of the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. In fact, Hasidus, some see, is kind of a counterweight to the Haskalah that was attracting so many Jews away from Judaism. So one of the great Maskilim was a fellow, Salman Maimon. Have you heard Salman Maimon? Salman Maimon is the name he gave himself. He was a person who was, he was raised Orthodox, and he left Torah life and the like. But he was a seeker of wisdom. So he wrote a very famous autobiography. It's called The Autobiography of Salman Maimon. I think the language he wrote it was in German. And he talks about the fact that he was raised in a strictly Orthodox home, and his parents married him off when he was 13. In fact, he even tells a story there that he was told by one of his friends that before you break the glass under the chuppah, he tells the story. I mean, some of it is, he may be a late, he may be mocking, but he said he was told by his cheder friends, he was getting married at 13, before you break the glass under the chuppah, be sure that you step on your wife's foot first, and you then have to say the pasuk, for who yimshol bach, he will rule over you. It's a chava. He says, gotta do it. So this is a 13-year-old kid, and you know, he's really worried, he has to be sure to do this, and he's about to step on her foot, and she steps on his foot first! Because she knew the trick. So he says, what can I do? You know, the marriage was doomed from the very beginning. Okay. But anyway, I think he actually left her, gave her a get, you know, whatever it was. But he wanders around, and at one point, he says, he wanders into the Beis HaMedrash of Rabbi B of M. And he discusses what he saw there, in some negative terms, actually. And most people who are familiar say Rabbi B of M, he only uses initials, is Rav Ber, Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich. So he actually gives you a description, a contemporaneous description of the Magid of Mezrich. And overall, he didn't like Hasidim at all. He thought they were uncouth, and they were rude, and they were drinking. He was not impressed with Hasidim. But he seemed to be impressed with the Magid of Mezrich. He says, this was a special person. He talked about the fact that the Magid was dressed in white on Shabbos, and his home was open for everyone to come, and people would just say psukim to the Magid, and they would just throw out psukim, and he would weave them all into a talk, and he was able to. Now, again, since Maimon was not a religious person, he looked at this as a parlor trick, but he said he was so skilled in his craft that he could take all of these different verses and make a sermon out of it. Okay, in other words, he didn't look at it as a religious thing, but he was impressed with the trick. Okay, be it as it may. The Magid of Mezrich took the Baal Shem Tov's central ideas, and he wanted to make this a movement within Am Yisrael. And as a result, he gathered within him great, great people who became the third generation of Hasidus. Just to give you a few examples, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev was a disciple of the Magid. The famous Rav Zusha, all those Rav Zusha stories, right, that Rav Zusha says, God's not going to ask me, why wasn't I Moshe Rabbeinu, God's going to ask me, why wasn't I Zusha? He was a Talmud of the Magid of the Mezrich. Although it is recorded in Svarim that Rav Zusha couldn't learn a lot from the Magid, because every time the Magid started saying anything, Rav Zusha got so ecstatic that he had to be carried out of the room. So if the Magid would say, V'yedaber Hashem el Moshe Lamor, Hashem spoke to Moshe, so Rav Zusha was seized with ecstasy. Oh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu came down into the world and spoke to Moshe. Oh, how holy that was. So he had to be carried out and the like. Rav Zusha's brother became really the founder of Hasidus in Poland, the Rebbe, Rebbe Elimelech of Lezhensk. You see? So these are two brothers, Rav Zusha and Rebbe Elimelech of Lezhensk. And then you had two other brothers, Rav Shmelka Horowitz and Rav Pinchas Horowitz. Let me point out that Rav Pinchas Horowitz, for those in the yeshiva world, was a world-class gain in halacha. He was the author of the Hafla in Maseches Ksuvos. If you learn in yeshiva, the Hafla is considered to be perhaps the most significant sefer ever written on Maseches Ksuvos. And yet he was a Rebbe of the Chassam Sofer, who was not a Chassid, but the Hafla was a Chassid. The Hafla was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mizrach. So the Hafla did not become a Chassidish Rebbe. The Hafla became the Rebbe of Frankfurt, etc. But the Hafla was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mizrach. So you had world-class Gedolim. The youngest of the disciples of the Maggid of Mizrach was a 19-year-old boy. Most of the Talmudim were much older. And this 19-year-old was of Shneur Zalman of Liadi. And what's fascinating is, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, by the age of 19, he already knew Shas and Shulchan Aruch, that was a given. He had already learned much Kabbalah, because non-Hasidim learned Kabbalah as well. And then at the age of 19, he was thinking, where should I go? I need a Rebbe to teach me the Derech HaChayim. Teach me how to serve God. What's interesting is, he was undecided. He had two different places he was considering to go. Mamish, listen to this. One was he heard of the Maggid of Mizrach. And the other is he heard of the Vilna Gaon. Can you imagine that? The Alter Rebbe almost became the disciple of the Vilna Gaon. He wouldn't have become a Chassid. What broke the tie was that he figured, well, the Vilna Gaon, of course, is a master of Shas and everything else, but he says, I'm nowhere on the Madrega of the Gaon, but that would kind of be more of what I already have. The Maggid would teach me something new. And Rav Shneur Zalman was considered to be, was the youngest of the Chabura, and he stayed with the Maggid for 4 years, unlike the Berditchever that had been with the Maggid, because the Maggid died just shortly afterwards. The Berditchever had been with the Maggid much, much longer. Right, everyone knows Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev, the one who emphasized loving Israel in all the different ways. You know all the stories of the Berditchever. The Berditchever who wrote the Kedushas Levi. The story goes that he once met a Jew who was smoking on Shabbos. And he said to the Jew, Reb Yid, do you know that it's Shabbos? And the Jew says, yeah. Reb Yid, do you know you're not supposed to smoke on Shabbos? He says, yeah, and I don't care. So the Berditchever turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, Ribono Shel Olam, Mi Kiyamcha Yisrael. Even when the town rabbi confronts a Jew will not lie. A Jew only tells the truth. Isn't this a wonderful, wonderful midah? Mi Kiyamcha Yisrael. They tell another story about the Berditchever, that for a while he too was wandering from town to town. He eventually became Rav of Berditchev, but he once shows up. Imagine this would happen here. It's Kol Nidre night. And this rabbi just shows up. And this rabbi just walks to the Amud to start leading Kol Nidre. I mean, nobody asked him, and I assume they had somebody else. Okay, so people are wondering, but such a beautiful Kol Nidre, so they don't stop him. He does Kol Nidre, he does Ma'ariv, he then stands the whole night saying Tehillim. He then davens Shachris the next day, Kriyas HaTorah, Haftorah. He does Musaf, he does Mincha, he does Ne'ilah. People are astounded. This has to be an angel. A human being can't do this. He was up all night, standing all night. He davens every single davening. And then at the end of Ma'ariv, he collapses and he says, I'm starving, I'm starving. So people say, finally we see he's a human being. And they bring him food and he says, no, not for food, I didn't learn Gemara for 24 hours. And he learned all night. He didn't eat anything till after Shachris the next day. That was who the Berditchever was. And he was a colleague of the Balata, of the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe once said later, that people ask him, could you describe the miracles, like what Nisim happened in the Maggid's house? He says he doesn't even remember. He says, you could get miracles under the table. You just walk into the house, there's a miracle there, a miracle there. He says he wasn't even keeping a record of all of the Nisim that took place. But, like, what was the guy's name? Metternich. Remember Metternich, a famous Austrian statesman who divided up Europe, assigning, you know, different countries to different emperors? The Maggid of Meseritch, although he was crippled, he couldn't go anywhere. He had a grand plan for Hasidus to permeate throughout Europe. And because he had such a sense and an understanding of human nature, he would dispatch a given Rebbe to a given country or a given province, because that would be the Hasidut that is matim to those personalities. The Polish personality was warm and emotional. He sent Rebbe Elimelech of Lezhensk to start Hasidus in Poland. The Lithuanian personality was cold. Again, I know I'm stereotyping, but was cold, analytical, and highly intellectual. He sent Rav Schneer Zalman to do Hasidus in Lithuania. So Chabad Hasidus, in its inception, I'm not necessarily talking about what it became, that's another story, is a highly intellectual, philosophical Hasidus, which has a very big distrust of emotion. The Alter Rebbe distrusted emotion tremendously. And it was Lithuanian Hasidus. It was the only Hasidus that took in Lithuania. Because Lithuanians, you know, the Litvish Jews, again, I apologize for the stereotypes, but, you know, they're not so far untrue. The Lithuanian personality, the Litvish personality, you had to, number one, know your Torah well to be respected. You couldn't just be an emotional guy. Have a Karl Bach minion or something. And number two, it had to be an intellectual type of Hasidus approach. So the Berditchever was to the Ukraine, and the Elimelech of Lezhensk was in Greater Poland. And other people, again, I don't have a list of every country, but he literally divided up Hungary, Czechoslovakia. He understood the needs and the personalities. And that is when Hasidus started taking off. That third generation of Hasidus is when emissaries would spread to different countries and the like. Now, let me point out that this process began in the lifetime of the Maggid of Meseritch. And as a result, this is when Misnagdim began to develop. In the Baal Shem Tov's life, there were no such thing as Misnagdim. I mean, who could be against the Baal Shem Tov? The Baal Shem Tov was a rabbi who was giving people chizuk and encouragement. He was not trying to create a movement. He was not trying to make himself a leader, even. So there was no musag of Misnagdim in the lifetime of the Baal Shem Tov. But towards the very end of the Maggid of Meseritch's life, there began to be opposition, and the strongest opposition, in fact, came from Lithuania. This is the Vilna Gaon's opposition. Again, the Vilna Gaon didn't start the opposition. I mean, the Vilna Gaon would not have known of Hasidus unless people told him about it. I mean, there were people who thought this was a dangerous movement, and next time I will talk about exactly what the dangers were, what were people against Hasidus for. And in 1772, which was just 4 years before the Maggid of Meseritch died, the Vilna Gaon, together with many other rabbis, signed a ban of excommunication, declaring Hasidim to be a sect that should not be part of Am Yisrael unless they do tshuva, forbidding intermarriage with Hasidim and the like. Very, very strict. I do know some Misnagdim who tell me, you know, the Vilna Gaon's ban has never been formally rescinded, and the like. We'll talk about that as well. So the Maggid, now again, let me point out that the Maggid had tremendous respect for the Vilna Gaon. Now, there were Hasidim of a lower level who really hated the Vilna Gaon. And in fact, when the Vilna Gaon died, they even rejoiced. But this was treated as a great, great sin by the Maggid and by Rav Schneer Zalman. And the Maggid was terribly heartbroken that his project to increase holiness in the world would be condemned by the great, great Gadol, the Vilna Gaon. So he sent two of his students to talk to the Vilna Gaon and explain what the movement was, because the Vilna Gaon might have been led astray by what people told him. And the two students they chose was Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi and Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk. And this is a very good choice, because again, if you want the Vilna Gaon to see Hasidus in its best light, you have to send people who are great Talmudic scholars. If you sent the Hasidim who were not great Talmudic scholars, the Vilna Gaon would have repeated and reiterated his opposition. So of all of the Talmidim of the Maggid, there is no question that probably the greatest Talmudic scholar was in fact Rav Shneur Zalman. He was an exceptionally great Talmudic scholar, besides being a Kabbalist. Rav Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk was a little older, also very eminent, but Rav Shneur Zalman in particular was a great, great Talmudist. So the Maggid put his best foot forward, and yet the Vilna Gaon refused to meet Rav Shneur Zalman, and the ban remained in effect. Chabad has a tradition that if the Vilna Gaon would have met Rav Shneur Zalman and would have made peace, Mashiach would have come right then, because the two worlds would have been united, as it were. But because of the ban, for a number of years, there was great, great tension between Hasidim and Misnagdim. And unfortunately, some of it involved getting the government involved, people being arrested on both sides as being counter-revolutionaries or whatever it is. I'll give you more of the history next week. But let me point out that the bitter fights between Hasidim and Misnagdim, you know, the denunciations and the like, lasted for only around 50 years. By the Vilna Gaon's successor of Chaim of Volozhin, things were much more peaceful. And the reason is because Hasidim and Misnagdim recognized they had a common enemy to fight. And that was the Reform movement and the Haskalah. So in a sense, why should we fight between us? And if anything, if you go back today, I mean, just to give you a little editorial comment, the main fights in Hasidus today are not between Hasidim and Misnagdim. They are between Hasidim and Hasidim, which is a whole other story we have to get to. How do you get to that? But you don't find, Misnagdim tend not to fight. In fact, even the word Misnagdim, we sometimes use the word, but it's not even a commonly used word today, because it really makes no sense. Misnaged means an opponent. I mean, nobody is an opponent of Hasidus. I'll just end with one little story to show why there's fewer fights today. Now, the story goes that a man had two daughters that he married off to Talmidei Chachamim. And, one he promised, he would support them for a while. So one son-in-law, he said, you will get a fleishik, hot fleishik meal every day. And the other son-in-law, he promised, I guess a different time for lunch, you will get a hot milchik meal every day with, cheese and cheesecake, all of those different things. So the sons-in-law were arguing who is considered to be more chashuv. One said, oh, I'm more chashuv, I get the fleishiks. No, I'm more chashuv, cheese is more expensive than meats per pound, whatever it is. And they were fighting. Each one said, I'm better than you. Anyway, what happened was, as often happened in Europe, the father-in-law became an ani, he was yored min chasav. He could not afford meat, he could not afford milk. So he could only give them potatoes. But to keep his promise, one person got potatoes in a fleishik pot. And one person got potatoes in a milchik pot. And they were still arguing who's more chashuv. So the father-in-law said, listen, fellows, when one guy got meat and one guy got cheese, you could fight who's better. But your potatoes with a little meat flavor and your potatoes with a little milk flavor, it's all the same. So some say, when Hasidim were real Hasidim and Misnagdim were real Misnagdim, people could fight. But today we're all like potatoes. Some potatoes have a little more Hasidic flavor. Some potatoes have a little more Litvisha flavor. Nothing to fight about, really, because, we're kind of all the same. Now, I say the big fights are among Hasidim. We'll talk about that. But next week, again, I'm going to get back to the Rav Shneur Zalman. What was the Vilna Gaon's opposition? How did Hasidus address that? And then hopefully we'll actually talk a little bit about the Tanya. Have a good one.